Thank you, everybody, for reading. And this is a speaker meeting, and I'm going to ask Harold to introduce our speaker tonight.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Harold.
Hi, Harold.
It's great to be back in your room. 4 years ago, I moved to Claremont, Florida from the west coast of Pasco County. And one of the first people I met was Willie. He is, in my time of sobriety, the hardest working man in AA that I know. He keeps a website with literally thousands of AA speakers and history. When I first moved there, I was attempting to get into the recording business, the voiceover artist, and Willie caught on to that right away. I got a job for you. So I recorded somewhere around 75 of the pioneers of AA, their stories, and Willie submitted all of those to GSO Archives, and they're now available to everybody through Archives. And it was information that was priceless. It's like reading about the history of AA. Wonderful. So, to this day, Willie puts in probably 12 to 18 hours a day on this site of his, and for the good of AA. A year ago, he went over to my friend Randy's house and filmed her telling her story and sent that off to GSO Archives. That is now there, and Willie handed her a letter tonight. Thanking the GSO, thanking her for dedicating his time to make this recording, because that's where our history is going to always be solid. It's in the stories of the people that came before us so that we have something to carry on. And tonight you are going to hear one of the most phenomenal AA stories that I've ever heard. This man is a real storyteller. You won't be able to understand a lot of what he's saying because he has this accent. But do the best you can, and I now introduce you to Willie.
Thanks, Tom, for that brief introduction. My name is Willie Burns. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. And tonight, I'm delighted that Ted's here, because this talk is for you. Okay. Pete told me before the meeting started, I've got about 40, 45 minutes to speak. There's people in this room who know me. They know that I'm a man of very few words. And if you believe that, you know, I'm asked to tell you what it used to be like. You'd be here till midnight. I'm asked to tell you what happened. You'd be here at midnight tomorrow night. And to tell you what it's like now, you'd be here for next week. But my whole life centers around AA, as Harold said. You know, I love AA with all my heart. I really do. And I would love to sit here tonight and tell you that from the very first time I came to AA, that I've never had a drink. And everything in my life has been wonderful. But that's not true. That's not true. What is true is that the worst part of my life started after I came to AA. The worst part. And it was bad enough when I came here the first time. Just to give you a rough idea what AA was like in the west of Scotland at that time. They were all speaker meetings, and the meetings all ran for 2 hours. You got a chairman, a speaker, and then the second hour, they'd go round the room. All you would hear were war stories. You wouldn't hear any talk about the big book. Nobody spoke about the steps. Some of the meetings over there, if anybody mentioned God, or higher power, or Jesus Christ, you were asked to leave the room. We're not here for that nonsense. We're only here for booze. That's the way it was. There was one guy in the area, he was Mr. AA. He had 29 years when he died. And I've often heard this man standing at a podium, and I've heard him saying, you know, I've never read the big book. I didn't want to become an F&A expert. And everybody looked up to this guy, Big Frank. Oh, what an example. I wouldn't wish his sobriety on my worst enemy. Trust me. And that's not a criticism of AA. These are just observations based on my own personal experience. I'm not going to get into a long dunkalogue because we really don't have time. I was the only boy in a family of six girls. My youngest sister, Elizabeth, she was buried on Monday, a few days ago. My six sisters are dead. Three of them died of alcoholism, and three of them died of cancer. But the miracle of our program is the one that should have been dead years ago, I'm still here. Somebody up there likes me. For years I used to say, well, the devil looks after his own. And I believe that. Thank God today I'm no different. I started drinking, you know, I was brought up in an alcoholic home. Both my parents were alcoholic. I couldn't wait to get the hell away from home. And I remember even in my early teens, I vowed that I would never drink. I'll never drink. Because I saw the hell that alcoholism caused in our house. I got married when I was 19. My wife was 16. Within a year, I'd moved out to London. I worked in the gambling industry even when I was in high school. And within a very short period of time, I was put in charge of about 40 betting shops in the London area, and I'm only 19. It was good for my ego. Drinking started off, as it does, I'm sure, with all of us, you know. And my drinking career at that time didn't last long, maybe about 5-6 years. And my ex-wife and her family, who were all good, devout Catholics, they were all concerned about this wee guy drinking. And they arranged for me to go and see a Catholic priest who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember going to see this guy. His name was Father Isaac McLaren. And Isaac McLaren will never be dead as long as I'm alive. But the first night I went to see him, we're sitting opposite each other in two armchairs, and he starts telling me about his drinking. Then out of the blue, he said to me, Willie, do you think you may be alcoholic? I felt insulted. I really did. And I'm sitting there, you know, with the lightweight, no hair suits on, pockets full of money. It was my money. My employers had stolen it. King Edward cigars and all the bling, you know. And I'm saying to myself, did nobody tell this guy about me? Does he not know who I am? Do you see, even then, you know, the degree of denial in me was so strong. And I remember saying to him, no, but I can't be an alcoholic. I've got too much money. He said, well, just keep drinking, son. It won't last you long. And again, I come back and I said, you know, I can't be an alcoholic. I don't drink wine and cheap wine and beer like the down and outs. It's nothing but the best for me. And that's when he explained to me that alcohol is not a drink. It's a drug called ethanol or ethyl alcohol. And like every drug in the market today, there's a certain proportion of the population who will have an allergic reaction to that drug. That one in the air out there. But again, I come back and I say, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I'm far too intelligent. And he said, yes, Willie, you're so effing intelligent. You can't count to one. If you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I couldn't wait to get the hell away from that night. And you know where I went. The nearest bar. You know, what the hell did he know anyway? That was 1970. A year later, drinking had carried on. I never drank in public bars. It was always in the cocktail bars with the dolly birds and the miniskirts and the outstanding futures. And, you know, that was my scene. So I remember coming out there one night, the Ingram Hotel in Glasgow, right across from where I worked with Joe Collins. And we were all going to a party over at the other end of Glasgow. And, you know, I was a paymaster, you know, bottles of this and bottles of that, and away we went. I remember coming out of that person's house that night, and it must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was pouring down with rain. And I remember sitting on the sidewalk, and the rain running under my feet, and some of my friends had gathered around me, and they're pleading with me, Willie, just stay here tonight. You're not fit to drive that car. You know, some of them even tried to take the car keys off me. You know, God almighty. I got in the car and I started driving. This was 1971. And to this day, I have no recollection of what happened. None. The first recollection I have is being given the last rites by another Catholic priest. The next recollection after that is a big black doctor standing over me with a clipboard asking me a load of stupid questions like, do you know what your name is? And I told him. He said, do you know what happened to you? And all I had to do was just look around the bed that I was tied into. You know, both legs were up in traction, my two arms were in plaster. It's a matter of medical record that I had over 250 stitches from there up. You know, my ribs were broken, my pelvis was broken. They had to cut me out of the car. They tell me the engine ended up in my lap. My right thigh was broken four places, my right shin was broken three, and I broke every bone in my right ankle. Both my arms were broken. My right wrist was nearly severed. They had to tie the tendons together under the skin, and they told me at that time that I would never walk again without a steel caliper, and I would never straighten my right arm and use my right hand. And my attitude all my life was, I'll show them. I'll show them. And would you tell me I can't do something? Just stand back. That was me. Very modest. I was in that hospital for 4.5 months. And the priest that had given me the last rites, he was a hospital chaplain, and his parish was straight across the road from Glasgow Royal Infirmary. And this guy used to come and sit with me almost every night. And, you know, we became really good close friends. He was like the brother that I never had. Eventually, after I was sent home, allowed home from the hospital, I lived away in the country. This guy used to come and visit me, maybe once a month, then it would be once a week, then a couple of nights a week. The steel caliper I wore that for a year. You know, then eventually I got rid of it. I get back to work and the drinking carried on just where it left off. The nightmare. I knew we were heading for a divorce, you know. They got to the stage of, like, you know, I just didn't want to go home. After we got married, my wife had 3 children within 2 years and 10 months. Then our married life was finished. That was it. Because of the Catholic Church. That was it, finished. And I'm only in my early 20s. And I'm living in London, the permissive society, and I was. You know? But the drinking just went from bad to worse. I remember the very first time I went to an AA meeting. 2 guys came to my house and picked me up on a Sunday afternoon, took me about 30 miles away. And I'm sitting in this room, and, you know, for the first hour when the guys were speaking, I couldn't tell you what the hell they were talking about. But when it came to the second part of the meeting, when they were going around the room, it seemed to me that everybody in that meeting all knew about me, because they were talking about some of the things I had done. And to show you how clever I was, I'm sitting there and I'm racking my brain, trying to think, how did they know about me? And then it hit me. You know, they must think I'm really stupid. When I get in the car to come over here, she's been on the phone to them and told them all about me. They've got together and they've said, when it's your turn, you say this is your turn. You know, I wouldn't want you to think I was paranoid. That's the way it was. When I started going to AA first, they suggested that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. To the best of my recollection, I did that. By this time, my wife had started going to Al-Anon. And I remember after the 90 days, I stopped the car one night, you know, had the wife and kids in the car, and we were on our way to visit her parents. And I stopped at a liquor store and I said to her, well, I'll just go in and get a quarter bottle of whiskey. I mean, I've proved it now. I've done the 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm cured. I'm cured. And she didn't go ballistic like she normally did. She just said, well, Willie, if that's what you want to do, you carry on doing it. And I didn't know that that quarter bottle of whiskey was going to be the start of me going in and out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 12 years. And during that 12 year period, I never got another 90 days. Never. Some of the guys in the early days, they would tell me, well, if you keep on drinking, you know, you're going to lose your wife, your kids, your own. And I thought, well, Dad, she couldn't live without me. You know, the great I am. But during that 12 year period, I lost my wife, my kids, my home, my jobs, two businesses. I lost the love and the respect of my family, my friends. I did quite a number of one-night stands in police stations, then ended up in Shorten Prison in Edinburgh. I tried to commit suicide two or three times, and they weren't half-hearted attempts. I got banned for drunk driving twice. First time was a year, it was mandatory. Second time it was 3 years, that was mandatory. And at that particular time, I owned the taxi business. One of the biggest taxi businesses in the west of Scotland. You know, I know how to run a business. But I lost all that stuff. But the only thing I did right during that 12-year period was I kept coming back to AA. I probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records for the number of times that I went in and out of AA. I said, the second time I was charged with drunk driving. That was on the 6th of March, 1985, and I was banned for 3 years. I had four witnesses in court that day to say what a nice guy I was. One of them was a doctor. He was a toxicologist. He was appealing on behalf of, in my behalf, to say that, you know, whenever the cops breathalyzed me, that the alcohol level, since it was an hour since I was in the accident, that I'd went home and I was so upset and I started drinking, and that's what accounted for that. They wouldn't buy it. I was banned for 3 years. Anyway, that was the start of my last drink, the day I walked out of that courtroom on the 6th of March. My last drink lasted 17 days, because towards the end of my drinking, I'd become a binge drinker, and I suffered greatly from blackouts. And because of all the injuries that I'd had for years, you know, I was addicted to prescription pills. But every time I started drinking, my legs would go on strike, you know. And I would just sit on the edge of my settee, you know, and urinate all over myself. And just to give you an idea how bad it was, I couldn't even get to the bathroom. And I hadn't shaved, and I'd just been sick all over myself. I lost another glass, and here we go again, I'm sure. I remember during the night that night, lying on the edge of my bed. And I don't say this to try and impress anyone or to try and frighten anyone. I remember bringing up pints of blood. And I remember at that time I said, well, it's probably the most honest prayer that I've ever said in my life. And I said, God, for their sake, help me. Help me. The next morning, there was an AA member came in my house. I didn't call him. I don't know how he arrived at my door, but he came. And his name was Andy Davison. And Andy wasn't years sober. Andy was only 15 months sober. And like me, Andy had gone in and out of AA for 12 years as well. And that day, Andy introduced me to this book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me that it's a manual of instruction, that this book tells me what to do, when to do it, how to do it, what will happen after I do these things, what will happen to me if I don't do these things. And he told me it's a textbook. And it tells you that down there. This is the basic text. A textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. Then he opened the book on the very first page, and the tremendous hope that he gave me was, there it says, some big letters, it says Alcoholics Anonymous. And underneath it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered. Past tense. Doesn't say are recovering. It says have recovered. But he was quick to point out to me that the word recovered doesn't mean cured. It just simply means to get well. In the book it tells me that all I have is a daily reprieve. That's all I've got today. You know, even after 78 years since this book's been in existence, the world record for sobriety, and it's never been beaten, is 24 hours. Last month I celebrated 28 years of continuous sobriety. And I've got an apology to make. I know nothing about drugs. The only thing I know about drugs is grass is a stock you walk on, and coke comes in a can. That's it. As I say, Andy introduced me to this book. And it started going through parts of it that were read out tonight. You know, and I turned to chapter 5 in the book. That for all the hundreds of meetings that I'd been to over the 12-year period, I'd heard this extract from chapter 5 read out a million times. that Andy went to at the end of what was read out tonight, the three pertinent ideas. And the very next line in the book under that, it says, being convinced, we are now at step three. And that's in chapter 5. And he looked at me and he said, well, if we're now at step 3, where's step 1 and step 2? I said, I don't know. He said, well, that's in the first 4 chapters of the book, in the doctor's opinion. I didn't know that. Chapter 5 only tells me how to take step 3 and step 4. I didn't know that. Chapter 6, called into action, tells me how to take step 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. I didn't know these things. And I'd been in and out here for 12 years. Jesus. There's another one, it's called Working with Others, chapter 7. That's a whole chapter on the 12th step. Incredible. At that time, you know, this was the last chance saloon for me. It really was. You know? And I realized then, for me, and I only speak for me, I had to take this thing serious. Or just forget it. You know, I'm one of these people in AA, you know, see if it's not in the big book, don't tell me about it. I'm one of these guys, you know, that my life depends on this. And it really does. And that's not being melodramatic. That's the way I see it. If anybody would have told me 28 years ago, when I started getting sober, the things that would have happened in sobriety in my life, I would have laughed in your face. I really would have. You know, I would sit in the rooms, you know, for years and say, my name is William, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't even know what the hell an alcoholic was until I started studying the book. And I found out that I suffered from a twofold illness. Twofold. That I had a physical allergy. I'd heard guys in the meetings talking about the allergy. I thought it was just a plausible excuse. I know different today. My body is allergic to alcohol. And it always will be. But that's only part of the illness that I suffer from. You know, I suffer from this mental obsession that they talk about. One drink's too many and a thousand's not enough. That's me. Once I took a first drink, I could not stop. And for the 12 years I was going in and out of AA, you know, I wasn't drunk all the time. You can't stay drunk that length of time. You know, you die. But during all that time, you know, I really tried. I tried my damnedest to stop drinking and to stay stopped. And the only thing that I was using to try and stop was this tremendous willpower that I've got. And I've said it for years, I've never met anybody in AA who's got more willpower and determination than this wee guy sitting here right now. You tell me I can't do something, stand back. I'll show you. That's me. You know, the book talks about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's me. Is that someday, somehow, I'll be able to do two things. I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And it goes on to say that the persistence of this illusion, it's on the mind, is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And it was read out tonight as well. I learned, that I had to fully concede to my innermost self when I was alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery. It's not sitting in a room and saying, my name's Willie, I'm an alcoholic. I had to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. The second part of the step talks about an unmanageable life. My life was unmanageable because I was powerless with alcohol. I had something else in my favour. I had an idiot trying to run my life for 42 years. The great I am. I heard Chuck Chamberlain on one of his talks talking about it. The guy's a legend in AA. You hear Chuck C saying, you know, that for 42 years of his life he was a failure as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a businessman, as a drunk. So was I. But once I gave in, that's when my journey really started. I'm only 2 weeks sober. 2 weeks. I was the fourth member of the very first big book study group in the west of Scotland. There were three other guys. It was Andy, it was Tommy Dockery, it was Felix Mullen and me. I was a fourth one. And every day, because we were all welfare at the time, the guys would come to my house and we'd have meetings in my house and we'd sit and we'd read the book. the book and study the book, and we go to meetings all over the place. And, you know, but I'm 2 weeks sober, and I'm standing on the main street in the town that I lived in, and I'm standing talking to someone, a guy in the afternoon. And he wasn't even an AA member, I can't even remember what the hell I'm talking about. But it was just a feeling that came over me. And I can't describe it any better than I just did. It was just a feeling that I had. And I knew, in my head and in my heart, that I would never drink again. I knew it. You know? Mm-hmm. My God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. I've changed my ideas on that over the time I've been sober. I don't believe that my God removed the obsession to drink, because if he did that, that would create a vacuum. I believe that my God has replaced my obsession to drink with an obsession to stay sober and to help other people. And that's what I'm trying to do. In the first few weeks I was sober, we managed to borrow some cassettes of Joe and Charlie. And I remember sitting at home on my own. You know, I'm the guy who wrote this book about. I had so many problems I despaired of ever solving them. You know, I was up to there in debt, you would not believe it. I wouldn't pay anybody when I was drinking. You know, why waste good drinking money paying it? You know, get away. I'm listening to these two guys, Joe and Charlie, on a cassette, and they're telling you what page they're talking about and to underline it. And they're talking about pages that I'd read 50, 100 times. But all of a sudden, just by listening to these two guys, it began to make sense. Then I started beating myself up again, thinking, well, how the hell did I not see that? You know, we don't get this program in great big chunks. You only get it a little bit at a time when God is ready to open your mind. That's the way we get this program. You know, the second step in this program is the single most difficult one for me, because in there it says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. I didn't believe in a power greater than me. I was brought up Catholic in the west of Scotland, and since I was that size, it was brainwashed into me, you know, that I was going to end up roasting in the back fire, you know, because of this God of hell and damnation. That's the way it was for me. And my early teens had got to the stage, you know, to help him. I don't need him, we'll do things my way. You know, the song that Frank Sinatra made, My Way, they tell me that's number one in the hit parade in hell, the number of people who tried to do it their way in AA. This is the easiest, softest way that I've ever found. If there would have been an easier, softer way for me, going in and out for 12 years, I would have found it. I didn't. This is it. You know, but again, Andy was the guy that said to me, he said, but Willie, he said, that God that you believed, I didn't believe in, he said, he hasn't worked for you. He said, why don't you pick a new God? I thought he was mad. What do you mean, pick a new God? He goes in there. You can choose any conception of God that you like, providing it makes sense to you. Even today, it does not make sense to me to believe in a vindictive God. So I was willing to change my attitudes. And in this book it says, as soon as a man can say that he's willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. And certainly in my case, what it seemed at first to be a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving hand of God. That's why I'm here tonight. You know, I can talk to you about God from there next week. It's incredible. I came to believe that he could restore us to sanity. The implication in step two is that I was insane. I wasn't insane. I'd never been hospitalized, I'd institutionalized because of my drinking. You know? You see, again, the book explains this subtle insanity, and it happens to each and every one of us when we are stone cold sober. And you're stone cold sober. That's when the insanity hit me. You know, the wee idea in your head, well, maybe it wasn't really as bad as all that. This time it will be different. When your team wins, you have a drink to celebrate, and you get beat, you drink to join the service. Well, there are a thousand excuses for taking a drink. I didn't have one reason. And that's the sort of insanity that's in step two. It gave me a tremendous sense of relief when they asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of my God. You know, in step one, my life was unmanageable. So it makes sense to me, if it's unmanageable, you get a new manager. And that's what I did in step three. When I came in step three, I knelt down in my bedroom on my own and I read the third step prayer out of the book. If you believe in miracles, here's a belter for you. The very first Catholic priest that I was sent to see in 1970, and this is now 1985, the guy I was sent to see, Father Isaac McLaren, the Catholic Church had moved him, and he was in a parish less than a mile from where I lived. He was down the bottom of the road. And I went down and spoke to Isaac McLaren, and I said, you know, whatever, and I'd come to the example of, in the fourth step about Mr. Brown and Mrs. Jones, it did not make sense to me. And for some reason, I think it's not meant to make sense to us. But that's my opinion, what the hell do I know? But I went down and asked Isaac, I said, you know, I'm looking for some advice on the fourth step. And at that time in our area, they started handing out the John Charlie four-step inventory guides. It's just an extension of the example in the book. And I'd never seen it, and Isaac McLaren had never seen it, but this time he was over 20 years old. And Isaac said, well, Willie, he said, I don't know about those inventory guides. He said, but let's see what it says in the book. Let's see what the book says. And in the book it says that you might not overcome drinking until you tell someone else all your life story. And that's what it says. So he said to me that day, he said, okay, he said, if you're looking for advice on the fourth step, he said, I would assume that you've taken the third step. I said, right. He said, how did you do it? And I told him, I knelt down and read the prayer. And he said, do you mind if we do it again? So the two of us knelt down, we said the third step prayer. When we stood up, he said to me, well, you know, if you're sincere about the decision you've just made, he said, by now you should be trusting in God. He said, if you trust in God, he will not allow anything bad to happen to you. And he said to me, do you believe that? And at that time, no, I didn't believe it. But I wanted to. You know, in chapter 5, it says we stood at the turning point. That's step 3. It says we asked his care and protection. So he's going to care for you and he's going to protect you with complete abandon. He said, well, all you have to do from today on, and if you forget everything that I've said here tonight, please don't forget this. He said, all you have to do from today on is just learn to accept everything that happens to you today, the good and the bad. Don't argue, don't struggle, don't fight it. Just accept it as being God's will for you, just for today. And then he said, and do the same thing tomorrow. And I remember looking at him and thinking, shit, that'll never work. But I'm going to try it just to prove you wrong. And you know, I've been doing that now for the last 25 days and 4 weeks and 28 years. And it's never wrong. I dare you to try it. That's how simple this program is. That's how simple it is. You know, I can say tonight without fear of contradiction from anybody that my God has done for me what I couldn't do for myself. He said, I don't want you to tell me anything today. He said, go home, get a writing pad and write down everything you can remember up until you're 15. And going back to chapter 5, it says that some of these we bought. And I remember saying to him, wait a minute, pal. I didn't start drinking until I was 21, 22. He just smiled. He said, well, go home and get a writing pad and write down everything you can remember up until you were 15. And when I was leaving, he said, and it's not a race. Take your time. It took me a few weeks. And when I went back down, I shared it with him, the life up there was 15, growing up in an alcoholic home. He was able to point out to me, just by what I'd written down, that I suffered from the effects of this illness through what he calls a family illness, since I was that size. Up to the age of 15, I was a thief and a cheat and a liar. And my sex life up there was 15, I'm still not too proud of it. But those were all the ingredients that shaped my life for the rest of my life. When I was leaving on that day, he said, now I want you to carry on doing the same thing with the rest of your life in 5-year cycles. And I did that. Well, again, when I was leaving on that day, he said to me, he said, now you worked in the gambling industry, didn't you? I said, yeah. He said, all right. He said, Al, I'll bet you right now. He said, I've no idea the things you might tell me happened whenever you left school and you moved down to London. And, you know, he said, Al, I'll bet you right now that it's just a repetition of everything you did up until you were 15. And again, I remember looking at him and thinking, are you in for a surprise, Pat? The things I've done. But you know, he was dead right. He was dead right. I shared my fifth step, you know, with Andy Davison. Took me a few months to get my fourth step done. And I never ever wanted the day to come when I would look back and wonder, did I do it right? Andy came to my house on a Sunday morning, and there were still some of the things I was still going through. I was still very afraid and very apprehensive. You know, the things that I'd done, mainly to do with sex, that I vowed, you know, I would never share with another living soul. I would take them to the grave with me first. And on the 23rd of March 1985, I nearly did that. But Andy came that Sunday morning, and thank God for Andy Davison. Because before I got a chance to tell Andy anything, Andy went into great detail and told me a lot of the things that he had done. And that's what gave me the courage and the confidence to go on and admit the exact nature of my problems. I remember how I felt at the end of that session. It lasted 6 hours. Physically it was draining, but mentally or emotionally, call it what you like, I felt as high as a kite. I felt as though a great weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I wanted to run out and tell everybody, you know, from the wee guy that was afraid and apprehensive. And again, I've heard Chuck Chamberlain describing that, and he said for him it felt like an inside shower, and I felt clean. For the first time in my life, I felt clean on the inside as well as the outside. And it's a feeling that I still enjoy. It's fabulous. Step 6 and 7 in this program, it's only a prayer. It's only 8 lines. You know, and providing you follow the directions in the book. No, it's only a prayer. And at the end of that prayer, it says, at the beginning of it, it says, you know, this thought brings us to step 6. Then it's a prayer, and at the end of it, it says, we have now completed step 7. I've been at meetings where they've spent an hour talking about the difference between step 6 and step 7. Absolute nonsense. Keep this thing simple. You know, they taught me years ago in Scotland, don't analyse this program, utilise it. Use it. That's what it's there for. When it came to step 8, I remember saying to Andy Davison, Andy, I can't do this. In step 8, I said, Andy, I wish they had left out the last word. Because in step 8, it says, we made a list of the people we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I said, Andy, I wish they'd have left out the last word. Because there's one guy that I will never make amends to. Never. I told you in 1971 I was given the last rites by the Catholic priest. And he used to come out and visit me after I was allowed home from Moscow. It became like the brother I never had. We were the best of drinking pals together. After me and my wife split up in 1976, he married my wife. And I told that guy right to his face one day, if ever I see you in this area, I'll put this car right over there from talking. And he knew I meant it. And I'm not here trying to impress anybody. My family knew the violence that this wee guy was capable of. I'm not proud. The last few years that my mother was alive, my mother lived in abject terror that I was going to end up in prison doing a life sentence for killing that guy. And I said to Andy, Andy, I'll never make amends to that guy. And Andy said to me, well, I said, you'll drink again. And that stopped me right in my tracks. Because I didn't ever want to go back to the hell that I'd come out of. And I said, Andy said to me, you're going to have to pray for him. I said, pray for him? I'd bury him in my front garden. I said, well, I said, it's up to you. And I started praying for that guy. I didn't mean it at first, but I kept on praying for him. And I got to the stage after a few years when I was asking my God to give that man the same blessings as they've given me. The ninth step, I've made direct amends. Direct means face to face. It's not about running around knocking doors and saying I'm sorry. I said I was sorry a million times. Didn't mean it once. I could spend the next hour talking about amends. You know, I try and live every day in my life today by step 10, 11, 12, because that's what this book tells me. I'm going to try and cut this short because
We started late, so you have like 7 minutes.
Anyway, step down in this book, ask me just to look for four things in my daily life and day. He asked me to look for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's the things that I found out in the first step. And it tells me in there what to do about it. The Scottish version of the four step, I'll tell you that one. It says we continue to take personal inventory, and if we were wrong, probably admitted it. No? Okay. Step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. And prayer, for me, is just talking to my God, and I talk to my God just the way I talk to every one of you. You know, I believe that God is everywhere, and if God is everywhere, then I can speak to Him anywhere. And I call him a silent partner. I take him with me everywhere I go. And I don't have to run to buildings to talk to him. And I talk to him all the time. You know, again, going back to Chuck Chamberlain, they asked him, saying, at one point they said, he's often by himself, but he's never alone. I've lived on my own for the last 28 years, through choice. You know, in the early days of my sobriety, I was asking God, you know, just, I'd love to meet a woman I could spend the rest of my life with. You see, my God saves me from myself. And I'm only 28 years sober. I wouldn't inflict me on any poor woman. Trust me. Step 12 is the reason why I'm here tonight. Because I'm asked to do something very specific and very precise. Because in step 12 it says, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, I have had many, many spiritual awakenings as a result of these steps. Then I'm asked to try and carry this message. Not the message, or any message, or Tom, Dick, or Harry's message, or Willie's message. Willie's message would kill you. Willie's message couldn't keep me sober. But I'm asked to try and carry this message. And again, I didn't know what this message was. And again, Andy Davison, this is our third edition. And about halfway down, it says this is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, pages 1 through 164, remains unchanged. Then it says, this is the AA message. That's it. And if I don't know what it says in the first 164 pages in this book, and if I haven't applied it in my life, how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? Even when I started getting sober, I never set out at any time to memorize any parts of this book with the intention of going to the meetings to try and impress the troops. Now let me tell you something, if you're in a big book discussion meeting with me, don't misquote it. You know, those vast chunks of this book are engraved in there and in there. That's just how serious I take it. Incidentally, in the fourth edition of the book, that part when it says this, the pages 1 to 164 remains unchanged, they've changed that. In the fourth edition it says, that was the AA message. Did you know that? That was the AA message. There's a big debate going on up at conference in GSO right now. They're trying to change it right back to what it said in the top. And so they should. Anyway, what the hell do I know? I'm just a wee drunk guy from Scotland. I'm going to back up, and I promise you I won't take too long. Okay? You can only imagine the anger and the hatred that I had against the Catholic Church and against that one man in particular. But again, this book saved my life, because there's a part in there where it says that we beg you to lay aside any prejudice you may have, even against organized religions, that we pick out the wrongdoings of one or two individuals and use that as a basis of wholesale condemnation of them all. And that's what I've been doing for years. I thank God for this. That's fabulous. You know, my wish for every one of you here tonight is that in time, I would wish that this book would come to mean as much to you as it does to me. I started coming over here on vacation in 1991. And I won't go into it, but I ended up staying with an EA friend through in Orlando, and I would come twice a year. Now, this time I had my own business in Scotland. I'd become a professional photographer. The reason that happened was, after me and my wife split up, she wouldn't give me any photographs of my own children growing up. And I bought a cheap little plastic camera. And if I would see my two daughters especially, I never saw my son for years, I would take pictures of my two kids for me. Never thought for a second that I would ever end up working professionally as a professional photographer all over Britain. And I never advertised. You see, my God just opens doors for me and he puts people in front of me. And I'm going to make you guys all jealous now, and I'm going to tell you what happened. I spent 15 years on the dancing scene, and I love telling the guys in AA, I have photographed some of the most beautiful looking women and girls all over the country, and at times they had hardly any clothes on, and they paid me. don't tell me God doesn't get a sense of humour. But I would come over here twice a year, because I've known business, I could afford to do that by this time. I became self-supporting through my own contributions. I managed to wipe out all the debts I had within 7 or 8 years. I was over here for 3 months in the winter of 1994. And I went back home to Glasgow, and I went to the Monday night meeting in Glasgow that I've been going to for years, and I knew everybody in the room. But this particular night, there's a big guy sitting down in the corner on his own, and I walked down and stuck my hand out, and the guy said, "My name is John," and I heard the American accent. And I said to him, "You know, are you here on vacation, John?" And he said, "No." He said, "I'm here as part of my job." So, of course, the next question is, "What do you work at?" He said, "I'm a Catholic priest." And that night, he asked me if I'd sponsor him. I spoke to him last night on the phone. He's now back up in Washington, D.C. And he's got 37 years. Incredible. I'll go back to the summer of 1998. At that time, I hadn't seen my kids for years. My youngest daughter, Geraldine. I'd built up a good relationship with my other daughter, Carol, for 8 years, but I hadn't seen the youngest one. In the summer of 98, I got a letter from her telling me she was a patient in a psychiatric hospital not far from where I live, and when I go and see her. I was in that hospital within an hour to get that letter. When I saw her, I didn't even recognise her. She was like somebody out of Biafra. She was just a little girl anyway, but she was just skin and bone. They had a dope to the eyes of them. On pills. Excuse me. I spent the next 6 months. My business came to a standstill. I couldn't care less about the business. I spent the next 6 months trying to help my youngest daughter. Almost every day or every evening, she'd be in my house or I'd be in her house, and I was desperately trying to help. She was addicted to prescription drugs. She didn't do street drugs. She had been a nurse and injured her back lifting in patients, which is a common complaint. And that's when it all started. She went for x-rays and CT scans and you name it. That's the way it was. But I remember on the 2nd of January 1999, I was asked to speak at a meeting in Scotland again, not far from where I live. And I was talking to them about my youngest daughter. And most of the people in the room, they knew my daughter. They knew her. They'd known her for years. And I remember saying to them that night that I had to admit that I was powerless over Geraldine, that she made my life unmanageable. And I'd come to believe that only a power greater than me could restore her to sanity. That was the Saturday night, the 2nd of January. The Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, I got a phone call from my son that I hadn't spoken to in years, and he told me that Geraldine was dead. She committed suicide. She hanged herself. That was a Tuesday afternoon. Now, I assumed that she had hanged herself the night before, because her mother had gone to the house and couldn't get in. She knew Geraldine was home. because the cat was there, the dog was barking, but my ex-wife didn't have a key for Geraldine's apartment because Geraldine wouldn't give her one. They had to get the cops and they broke in, that's when they found her. The next day, the Wednesday, when we got the autopsy report, that's when they told us that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Saturday night, the night I turned her role in my life over to the care of my God. And I thank God at that time for all the friends that I had over here. And I mean this with all my heart. Because at that time, there was a weekend between there and the funeral. My house was packed day and night with people from AA and some of my family and friends. And it would come 11, 12 o'clock at night and they would all go home because they've got their own jobs and their own families and stuff. But you see, when it's midnight in Scotland, it's only 7 o'clock in the evening over here. And I was on the phone every night of the week to friends here in Orlando and Naples and Melbourne, Father John up in Washington DC, breaking my heart crying. And I couldn't care less how much the phone bills were. I didn't care. But you know, I needed all that support to get me through that. What happened on the day of the funeral? Trust me, you'd be here for another 2 hours. You don't want to know. Anyway. For the next 12 months, it seemed as though I was hit by a series of express trains. You know, I lost two of my sisters in that year. Some of my friends over here died of alcoholism. It was just one thing. I had a nephew that committed suicide. It was one thing after the other. But the important thing I'm trying to get through to you tonight is that during all that madness and all that insanity that was going on in my life, the thought of a drink never even crossed my mind at once. You know, I could have made a career out of self-pity. You know, some of the stuff I've been through. And that tells me this program works. And the reason I tell you these things tonight is not looking for sympathy from any of you, but it's just to point out to you that if these things can happen in my life, they can happen to anyone. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened. It really is. We have tapped into a power in AA more powerful than the atomic bomb. We really have. And it's fabulous. And I just love it. And as Alan said earlier, you know, my whole life centers around AA. I get people from all over the world sending me stuff to put on the website. Yesterday I went to the post office and I mailed back an external hard drive. There were some members in Germany and Sweden that sent me another 4,500 AA talks. Right now, if you come to my house right now, the whole kitchen, all the worktops, all tile time, cassettes, they all came from the Lakeland Indian group. They brought them over on Tuesday. It'll take me a couple of months to go through all them. You know, but I thank God for this because it gives me something to do. And Harold mentioned the website that I have. Right now there are more than 23,000 talks on the website that anyone all over the world, you can download them for free. Now in the early days when I was coming over here on vacation, I went to a lot of conventions. It's expensive to go to conventions. It's bloody expensive. And you can buy the CDs of the speakers, and it might cost you $10. There's a lot of people in AA can't afford $10. They haven't got it. You see, I believe what it tells me in this book, to get freely of what you find. And that's what I do, and I've been doing that now for the last 28 years. You know, and I love it. Absolutely love it. Trust me, I could go. I'm just getting wound up. I'll say that to Peter out there. And if you don't believe me, come in my house. You're all welcome. Then we'll have a convention and you can speak. I'm going to wind up just by using the words of Father Isaac McLaren. And every time I heard him speaking, this is how he would finish up. And I would hear him saying that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't come into existence to make life easy, but it did come into existence to make men and women great. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you tonight for listening to me, because tonight again, I feel great. Thanks.
Thank you.